start the entrance exams at the beginning, classification and aptitude, but she knew the answer even before the thoughtful question was completed. Under the fear of being washed out, weaker ones would not pass. The Solar Guard could not afford to have cadets and later Solar Guard officers who could not function under pressure. She began handing out the tubes, and one by one, the green-clad candidates stepped to the front of the room to receive them.
Excuse me, ma'am?
Falteringly.
If I wash out as a cadet, as a Solar Guard officer cadet,
he gulped several times.
Does that mean there isn't any chance of becoming a spaceman?
No, she answered kindly. You can become a member of the enlisted Solar Guard if you pass the acceleration test.
Thank you, ma'am.
Tests given on the basis of the entrance exams he had taken at New Chicago Primary Space School. He opened the tube, pulling out the four sheets, printed on both sides of the paper, and read the heading on the first. Astrogation, communications, signals, radar. He studied the first question. What is the range of the Mark 9 radar scope? And how far can a spaceship be successfully distinguished from other objects in space? He read the question four times, then pulled out a pencil and began to write. Only the rustle of papers, or the occasional sigh of a dead over a problem, disturbed the silence of the high ceiling of the room, as 100-odd cadets fought the questions. There was a sudden stir in the room, and Tom looked up to see Roger Manning walk to the slot and casually deposit his tube in the green-bordered slot. Then he leaned idly against the wall, waiting for it to be returned. As he stood there, he spoke to Dr. Dale, who smiled. There was something about his attitude that made Tom boil.
So fast?
He glanced at his own papers. He had hardly finished two sheets and thought he was doing fine. He clenched his teeth and bent over the paper again, redoubling his efforts to triangulate a fix on Regulus by using dead reckoning as basis for his computations. Suddenly, a tall man wearing the uniform of a Solar Guard officer appeared in the back of the room. As Dr. Dale looked up and smiled a greeting, he placed his fingers on his lips. Steve Strummer, Captain in the Solar Guard, gazed around the room at the backs bent over busy pencils. He did not smile, remembering how, only 15 years before, he had gone through the same torture, racking his brains trying to adjust the measurements of a magnetoscope prism. He was joined by a thin, handsome young man, Lieutenant Judson Saminsky, and finally warned Officer McKenney. They nodded silently in greeting. It would be over soon. Strong glanced at the clock over the desk. Another 10 minutes to go. The line of boys on the slots grew until more than 20 stood there, each waiting patiently, nervously, for his turn to drop the tube in the slot and receive in return the sealed cylinder that held his fate. Still at his desk, his face wet with sweat, Astro looked at the question in front of him for the 15th time. Estimate the time it would take a 300-ton rocket ship with half-filled tanks, cruising at the most economical speed, make a trip from Titan to Venusport. A. Estimate the size and maximum capacity of the fuel tanks. B. Give estimate of speed ship would utilize. He thought. He slumped in his chair. He stared at the ceiling. He chewed his pencil. 5 seats away, Tom stacked his examination sheets neatly, twisted them into a cylinder, and inserted them into the tube. As he passed the line of desks and headed for the slot, a hand caught his arm. Tom turned to see Roger Manning grinning at him.
Worried, space boy?
Asked Roger easily. Tom didn't answer. He simply just threw his head. You know, said Roger, you're really a nice kid. It's a shame you won't make it. But the rules specifically say, no cabbage heads. No talking, Dr. Dale called sharply from her desk. Tom walked away and stood in the line at the slots. He found himself wanting to pass more than anything in the world. Please, he breathed. Please, just let me pass. A soft gong began to sound. Dr. Dale stood up. Time's up, she announced. Please put the papers in the tubes and drop them in the slot. Tom turned to see Astro stuffing his papers in the thin cylinder disgustedly. Phil Morgan came up and stood in back of Tom. His face was flushed. Everything okay, Phil? Inquired Tom.
Easy as free fall in space, replied the other cadet.
His soft Georgian drawl, full of confidence.
How about you?
I'm just hoping against hope. A few remaining stragglers hurried up to the line.
Astro will make it? Asked Phil.
I don't know, answered Tom. I saw him sweating over there like a man facing death.
I guess he is, in a way.
Astro took his place in line and shrugged his shoulders when Tom leaned forward to give him a questioning look.
Get ahead, Tom,
urged Phil. Tom turned and dropped his tube into the green bordered slot and waited. He stared straight at the wall in front of him, hardly daring to breathe. Presently, the tube was returned in the red slot. He took it, turned it over in his hands, and walked slowly back to his desk.
You're washed out, Cabbage Head,
Manning's whisper followed him.
Let's see if you can take it without bawling.
Tom's face burned, and he fought an impulse to answer Manning with a stiff belt in the jaw. But he kept walking, reached his desk, and sat down. Astro, last to return to his desk, held the tube out in front of him as though it were alive. The room was silent as Dr. Dale rose from her desk. All right now, boys, she announced. Inside the tubes, you'll find colored slips of paper. Those of you who have red slips will remain here. Those who find green slips will return to their quarters. Blue will go with Captain Strong, orange with Lieutenant Siminski, and purple with Warrant Officer McKenna. Now please open the tubes.
There was a tinkling of metal caps and then a slight rustle of papers as each boy withdrew the contents of the tube before.
Tom took a deep breath and felt inside for the paper. He held his breath and pulled it out. It was green. He didn't know what that meant. He looked around. Phil was signaling to him, holding up a blue slip. Tom's heart skipped a beat. Whatever the colors meant, he and Phil were apart. He turned quickly around and caught Astro's eye. The big Venusian held up the green slip. Tom's heart nearly stopped beating. Phil, who had breathed through with such confidence, held a blue slip. And Astro, who hadn't even finished the task, held up the same
head. The psychographs and Corbin, Manning, and Astro fit together like gears. And yet, the Solar Guard officer suddenly rose and walked over to his huge window that filled the entire north wall of his office. A solid sheet of glass extended from the high dome ceiling to the translucent floor. Through the window, he stared moodily down towards the grassy quadrangle, where at the moment several hundred cadets from March with formation under a hot sun. And yet, continued Strong, every morning for the last 3 weeks I've got a report from McKenney about some sort of friction between them. I think it'll work out, Steve, answered the pretty girl in the uniform of the Solar Guard, seated in an easy chair on the other side of the desk. Joan Dale held the distinction of being the first woman ever admitted into the Solar Guard in a capacity other than administrative work. Her experiments in atomic fissionables was the subject of a recent scientific symposium held on Mars. Over 50 of the leading scientists of the Solar Alliance had gathered to study her latest theory on hyperdrive, and had unanimously declared her ideas valid. She had been offered the chair as Master of Physics at the Academy as a result, giving her access to the finest laboratory in Triplanet Society. Now facing the problem of personality adjustment in Unit 42D, she sat across the desk from her childhood friend, Steve Strong, and frowned. What's happened this time? Manning. He paused. It seems to be all Manning. You mean he's more aggressive of the three? No, not necessarily. Corbett shows signs of being a number one spaceman, and that big cadet, Astro. Strong flashed a white smile and contrasted with his deep space tan. I don't think he could make a manual mistake on the power deck if he tried. You know, I actually saw him put an auxiliary rocket motor together blindfolded. The pretty scientist smiled. I could have told you that after one look at his classification tests. Oh, on the questions concerning the power deck operation, he was letter perfect. And on the others, astrogation and control deck. He just skipped by, but even where the problem involved fuel, power, supply of energy, he offered some very practical answers to the problem. She smiled. Astro is just as much an artist in that power deck as Louis Tamal doing Juliet in the Stereos. Yes, he's strong. And Corbett is the same on the control deck. Good instinctive intelligence. That boy soaks up knowledge like a sponge. Castle Mine. Quick to grasp the essentials. Smile again. Seems to me I remember a few years back when a young lieutenant successfully put down a meeting in space and had his promotion to captain. The citation included the fact that he was quick to grasp the essentials. Squad, she assured. A routine flight to Titan had misfired at the end of the rebellion bunker. Using a trick picked up in ancient history books of sea roving pirates in the 17th century, he had joined the mutiny, gained control of the ship, sought out the ringleaders, and restored discipline. And Manning, asked Strong, what about Manning? One of the hardest, brightest minds I've come across in the Academy. He has a brain like a steel trap. He never misses. And do you think he's acting up because Corbett is a nominal head of the unit? Does he feel that he should be the command cadet at the control deck instead of Corbett? No, replied Dr. Dale. Not at all. I'm sure he intentionally missed the problems about control deck and his classification tests. He concentrated on astrogation, communications, and signal radar. He wanted to be assigned to the radar lab, and he turned in the best paper I've ever read from a cadet to get the post. Strong threw up his hands. Then what isn't? Here we have a unit, on paper at least, that could be number one. A good combination of brains, experience, knowledge, everything that's needed. And what is the result? Friction. Suddenly a buzzer sounded, and on Steve Strong's desk, a small teleceiver screen glowed into life. Gradually, the stern face of Commander Walters emerged.
Sorry to disturb you, Steve. Can you spare me a minute?
Of course, Commander, replied Strong. Is anything wrong?
Very wrong, Steve. I've been looking over the daily performance reports on Unit 42D.
Dr. Dale and I have just been discussing that situation, sir. A relieved expression passed over the commander's face.
Good. I wanted to get your opinion before I broke up the Long John, and Dr. Dale, myself, field work boys for Unit 42D make a potentially best in the academy, if they stay together, sir. Walters considered this for a moment, and then asked thoughtfully,
"Give me one good reason why the Unit 42D wants them."
"The academy needs boys like these, sir," Steve answered flatly. "Needs their intelligence, their experience. They may be a problem now, but if they're handled right, they'll turn out to be ace-based development," the commander interrupted.
"You're pretty sold on them, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir, I am."
"Now, are all units assigned to their mission instructors?"
"Yes, sir. I've slipped Lieutenant Volchek from this unit. He's tough and smart. I think he's just a man for the job."
"I don't agree. Volchek was fine officer, and if any of the units would be no question. I think he has done a man for the job."
"Your new suggestion?" Commander leaned forward in his chair.
"Yes, Steve."
"Me?
What do you think, Jim?"
"I want to make the same suggestion, Commander," smiled Joe. "But I didn't know Steve really wanted to do so."
"Oh, what about it, Steve?"
asked Commander.
"The scenario is like my first world, but if you're so convinced that you're going to be in the future,
Thank you.
knocked your mother and father deaf in the ears to let you come to Space Academy and be a spaceman. You want to feel those rockets bucking your back out in the stars, eh? Yes, sir, replied Tom, wondering how this man who didn't even know knows so much about him. Well, you won't make it if I ever catch you disobeying orders again. McKinney turned quickly to see what effect he had created on the others. Stern lines of morbid faces satisfied him. This old trick of using one of the cadets as an example was a success. He turned back to Corbin. The only reason I'm not logging you now is you're not a space cadet yet, and won't be until you've taken the Academy oath. Yes, sir! McKinney walked down the line across the platform to an open teleceiver booth. The ranks were quiet and motionless, and as he made his call, McKinney smiled. Finally, when the tension seemed unbearable, he roared, "At ease!" and closed the door. The ranks melted immediately, and the boys fell into chattering clusters, their voices low, and they occasionally peered over their shoulders at Corbett, as if he had suddenly been stricken by a horrible plague. Brooding over the seeming ill fortune that compelled him to be his attention to the end of one day, Tom sat down on his suitcase to adjust his boot. He shook his head slowly. He had heard Space Academy was tough, tougher than any other school in the world, but he didn't expect the stir of this would begin so soon. This could be the beginning of the end. Roland waved his voice back to Tom. For some of the more enthusiastic cadets, someone might have thought Tom turned to see a boy about his age, maybe night, with close-cropped blonde hair, stood up pushing him all over his head. He was lunging lightly against the wall, looking smile on the eyes. Tom recognized him immediately as a bunch of men, with his pleasant features twisted into a scowl, from what I expected, naturally. Thank you.
presents.